Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Innovation Fellow for the Tech Congress, Chris Segoyan. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's nice to have you on. I've been wanting to do this for a long time because it kind of fits in with current events and some people I've had on the show before, like Cindy Cohen from the EFF. So you were a principal, this is pretty cool, you were the principal technologist and senior policy analyst for the American Civil Liberties Union, the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. Wow, what a mouthful. Tell me what that is all about and what the goals were.
Yeah, that's a lot of words. Essentially, for the last four and a half years, I was a subject matter expert. I was a nerd embedded in a team of lawyers. And I worked for the lawyers who sue the FBI for spying and who sue the NSA for spying on Americans. It was a pretty amazing job. I got to work with some of the smartest people in the country who work on these issues. And, you know, I was right in the trenches. My boss, Ben Wisner, was Snowden's attorney, so I got pulled into some of that stuff. We got to be involved in some of the most interesting legal and technology issues of our time, including the Apple FBI fight last year, and fights over whether the government can hack people's computers and when they can track their cell phones and when they can get their web browsing records from companies. So it was really pretty phenomenal job. I came to the ACLU straight out of a PhD program where I'd focused on surveillance, and so I was sort of really there at the right time in the right place. The organization, I think, recognized that surveillance was becoming so high tech that they needed to have an expert who could translate between the world of technology and the world of the law. And I had the right skills at the time when they were looking, and so they brought me on. And
so did the ACLU find you and recruit you? Did they know about you? Or was it like a job opening and you applied for it?
No, I didn't apply on their website. This was, I was a known entity at that time.
That's good.
There are not too many surveillance experts who have not worked in the government. And so I spent several years doing a PhD, and specifically studying how technology companies are deputized, sometimes willingly and sometimes unwillingly, by the government to help the government spy on their customers. And so I finished this hybrid PhD of computer science and law with pretty specific knowledge at a time. Really, before many people were paying attention to the topic of surveillance, before Snowden, before companies were competing on privacy, like Apple has done in the last couple of years, and so, you know, I was a known entity within the privacy community, and I had friends in the civil liberties arena, and I'd been represented by several civil liberties lawyers at that point. So
you had been represented. Is that something you want to tell us about?
I mean, I through the course of my research, I had come to the attention I had come to law enforcement's attention a couple of times. In graduate school, I made a website that made fake boarding passes to show how easy it was to get around the no-fly list.
Oh, the government doesn't like that stuff.
So that was the first time. And then later, I snuck into a surveillance industry trade show and secretly recorded an executive from Sprint bragging about the 8 million times they had given their customers' GPS data to law enforcement in 1 year.
Oh, bragging.
So I've had to hire lawyers a couple times now.
Okay. Well, you know, I read Michael Hayden's book, which is very interesting. And you come away from it's self-serving, of course. But Michael Hayden kind of gave me the impression that the government, high as NSA and CIA, has its own lawyers, and those lawyers kind of tell them, you know, what they can and cannot do in many cases. Would you characterize the situation as the government pushing the boundaries at every point and waiting for pushback, or do you see the government as saying, these are things we need to do and we think they're legal?
I mean, I think it's more complicated than that. there are some things where the lawyers will push things to breaking point, but stay within the bounds of what reasonable people can agree the law says. And then there, I think there are other cases where, you know, the political folks who are in charge decide that they want to do something, the law be damned, and then
it's the lawyers up to us to fight.
Right, and then the lawyers are tasked with sort of manufacturing a fig leaf of legitimacy for the program, and as long as the program can be kept secret, there's not really going to be anyone who's going to challenge that. And so, for example, you know, one of the biggest disclosures that came after Edward Snowden's revelations to the media was that the NSA had twisted the law in a way that no one would have ever expected, to permit the government to collect every single American's domestic telephone call records, with a statute that permitted the government to get records that were relevant to an investigation. And the government's theory was that every record of every American was relevant.
So these call records are metadata, right? It's the phone number and who was called, but it's not the actual recording of the conversation?
Correct. But, you know, so for certain telephone calls, the content is probably the most sensitive part. But for many telephone calls, the mere fact that a call takes place, who it's from and who it's to and at what time and how long that lasts, can be deeply sensitive, right? So think about a telephone call to a suicide hotline, or the telephone call to the reservation number for an abortion clinic. Does it really matter what you say on the suicide hotline? The fact that you spend 2 hours at 3 a.m. on a Friday night talking to someone on a suicide hotline, I think is pretty darn sensitive.
Let me play the devil's advocate here for a second. I'm on your side. I'm on Cindy's side. I believe in what you're doing. But let me just ask you a question. It occurs to me that all these sensitive areas are not things that would really pop up on the radar. I mean, if the government were writing algorithms to say, we need to look at things that pop up as national security issues, a phone number of some casual citizen to a psychiatrist is not going to send up red alarms. Maybe
not. Well, it's not about whether it sets up alarms. It's whether it could be useful to a government that decides that it wants to destroy the lives of its citizens.
So the idea is that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So we want to place limits.
Right. I mean, so, you know, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, the government tried to use his psychological records to discredit him. The government the U.S. government placed hidden microphones in Martin Luther King Jr.'s residence and hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. And secretly recorded him having extramarital affairs, and then sent recordings that had been made, along with a note basically telling him to kill himself. While we all hope for a good government, sometimes there are people who are not the best who end up in the White House. That has happened in the past, and you know, maybe that'll happen again in the future. I'm not pointing fingers in any particular direction, but you know, you don't. The rights that we have are not just there to protect us from the best leaders we can elect. They're also there to protect us from the worst leaders we could possibly elect.
Good point. Are there any notable cases that you worked on at the ACLU that really stand out, that helped quite a bit?
I mean, there are several things that I worked on that I'm really proud of. So we filed an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court brief, in a case involving a company called LavaBit, which was an email provider that tried to be a bit more private and a bit more secure than the norm. The government went to LavaBit to try and get the company's records. The company said, sorry, we use a form of encryption, so we don't have access to our customers' records. And the government said, that's fine, give us your encryption keys, and then we will decrypt the traffic ourselves. And LavaBit didn't want to give away an encryption key that protected hundreds of thousands of customers. And so we filed a brief in that case, and that was the first time that the ACLU had gone on record arguing that there should exist methods of communication that the government can never intercept. And that really laid the or created the precedent for the organization to then take an even stronger position in the Apple FBI case last year. So I was really proud of that. We spent a lot of time when I was there, over 4 years, trying to expose the use of a technology called a Stingray, which is a device that impersonates cell towers and allows the government to track people's phones.
Oh, yes. So what about those?
Right. So when I joined the ACLU, one of the first things I did was push my colleagues to file a brief in a Stingray case. And that ultimately led to a pretty large project where we were training defense lawyers around the country and advising folks who were doing this nationwide. And last year, the government announced a new policy where federal law enforcement agencies now promise that they will get a search warrant and promise they will no longer deceive judges and hide information about what they're planning on doing to the courts. So
good
that's
work.
Like, you know,
good work.
Pretty good. Those are just two projects I've done. I mean, that it was the 4.5 years went by pretty quickly, in part because of the Snowden disclosures and the subsequent significantly larger interest of the public in surveillance issues at large. But it was it was a pretty awesome gig.
I want to ask you, how did you get into this in the first place? What triggered your interest in this area? I mean, because most of us kind of start with computers at an early age and we start messing with them and we become tech geeks. But you've taken a different focus. How did that all happen?
I mean, I was a tech geek for most of my early career. I used computers from a very, very young age. My father was an electrical engineer. We had computers around the house. My undergraduate degree was in computer science. My master's degree was in applied computer security. I interned at tech companies like Apple and Google and IBM. And it was, I think, after that episode in grad school with the boarding pass website that I learned the importance of lawyers. And I also learned the importance of the law. And so after that happened, I started taking some classes in the law school. And it turned out that, A, I liked the law. And, B, I realized that I was better at bridging the divide between the world of technology and law than I was of actually being an engineer. I mean, I was an okay engineer, but I wasn't the world's best computer scientist. And what I did realize was that I had a knack for communicating about deeply complex things in plain English. And once I got a taste for advocacy and activism, once I started pressuring companies to fix security flaws, and I realized that I was actually really, really good at that. And cool. So I switched focus, and then when I ultimately changed my direction in my PhD program, I decided that I wanted to study this question that no one had looked at before, right? This question of how are tech companies forced to facilitate surveillance? And this wasn't something that you could learn by crunching data. This wasn't something you could learn by going down to the library. So what I did was I moved to Washington, D.C., and I started going out for drinks with lawyers who worked for companies and who worked for the government. And after a few drinks, they would usually tell me
about it. Nice.
I was able to learn an awful lot about something that at the time was not well known. At the time, tech companies were not publishing transparency reports. It was really a dark art that was only known to the lawyers who practiced before the FISA court and who worked for these firms and liaised between them and the government. And so I was able to sort of get an early glimpse at how the surveillance world worked, I think, which helped me when I then went to work for the ACLU.
Cool. Well, I want to take a break here real quick. When we come back, I want to ask you about work with the Federal Trade Commission. Folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. I'm talking to Chris Segoyan. So before the ACLU, you worked for the Federal Trade Commission on identity protection. I'm curious about that because we hear about identity theft all the time. What was the FTC doing, and did they make some progress, and what was going on there?
Yeah, so I worked for the FTC's Division of Privacy and Identity Protection. Specifically, I was sort of similar to what I did at the ACLU. I was a nerd embedded in a team of lawyers who investigated essentially companies' bad data security practices. So I worked on investigations of Facebook, of Twitter, MySpace, and Netflix, and you know, a company would be doing something they shouldn't be doing. They would, you know, have a data breach, or we would learn through either independent researchers or newspaper articles or consumer complaints that the company had was deceiving consumers about the extent to which they were protecting consumer privacy or violating their own privacy policy. And then we would investigate, and we'd send the company a letter, and we'd force them to answer a bunch of questions. They'd have to come in, and if we found that they were doing something that they weren't supposed to be doing, we would engage in discussions with them, and ultimately get them to agree to a consent order where they promised to improve their practices and agree to binding rules that if they broke that agreement in the future, and for the next 20 or 30 years, they could be fined. So it was, I was the first technologist to work full-time in that division, or in fact, at the Federal Trade Commission. It was really, really fun.
What's interesting about that is that there was a sort of a direct relationship between the FCC and the company. It wasn't like a public discussion. So you would get these consent decrees, and everything would go on behind the scenes, and you'd get the job done, but there was no like public discussion on a website where journalists could see what was going on. So you were working behind the scenes effectively and coercing these companies into doing the right thing. But it probably didn't make a big splash in the news because it was done directly, seems to me.
Well, no, so that's not true. So it's certainly the case that the negotiations happen behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. But that was because if the company was innocent, if in fact we have the wrong end of the stick and the company was doing a great job, you don't want that company's reputation to suffer, right? If there's a front page New York Times story that says Federal Trade Commission investigates, you know, Uber, that could impact their stock price. You know, that could hurt the company's reputation. So the investigations are kept confidential until the investigation is over. But if the FTC does find that the company violated Section 5 of the FTC Act, which bars unfair and deceptive business practices, then this consent order is typically agreed on, and then it's made public, and then there will be, you know, an article in the New York Times, and there's actually even a public comment period where members of the public can write in and say, that order is not enough. You know, you guys should hold them, you know, to stronger terms.
Cool. Well, along those lines, at FTC, you were also the father of what's called Do Not Track. I think our listeners are aware of that as a browser option that they can set. But as I understand it now, just about every browser supports that option. But there's been some discussion about the finances of that and whether websites are going to respect the setting. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I would say I'm the father. I'm probably a father. There were several parents of that that initiative. And really, the issue at the time was there was sort of an arms race where consumers would be given a tool by the web browser manufacturers that would allow them to stop some kind of tracking or some kind of annoying behavior. So think, you know, pop-up blockers or third-party cookie blockers or, you know, or some other features. And then the ad networks would initially be hit by this feature and it would work, and then there'd be a huge financial incentive for the ad networks to find a way around it, because mm-hmm. you know, if every ad network in the country is blocked, the first one that finds a way around it has this huge untapped market.
And hence, so the arms race.
hence the arms race. And you know, when confronted with this situation, you know, when we would talk to the ad networks, they'd say, oh yeah, you know, we didn't know the consumer didn't want to be tracked. We just thought they didn't want to be tracked through technology X or technology Y or technology Z. And that was sort of silly, but they could claim that consumers had not clearly signaled a desire to be left alone. And so the purpose of Do Not Track was to allow for a clear signal from the consumer to the ad industry saying, leave me alone. But you know, at the end of the day, it was just a signal, and there's no obligation for providers or for ad networks to respect it. And so what happened was that several web browsers added it. Google was the last web browser. Google Chrome was the last browser to add it, almost certainly because Google's ad network didn't want to respect it, and they were worried that if they had support in Chrome, that they'd be obligated to respect it. Initially, some ad networks did promise to respect it, in large part due to pressure they were facing from Congress and the Federal Trade Commission. But then the ad industry sort of parachuted in about 50 lawyers. They were able to sort of sabotage the negotiations that were taking place around the Do Not Track standards. And the end result was that the industry walked away and said, we're not going to respect this anymore. And so, you know, right. So the irony, of course, is now if you're a consumer and you want to not be tracked, the only mechanism you have available to you is ad blocking. You know, and I think there's a lesson to be learned here, which is, you know, the ad networks got greedy. Rather than, you know, working out some kind of medium ground where they could still show ads to consumers, but they wouldn't be targeted, they denied consumers the ability to have any kind of control. And so the only mechanism that exists now is one where the ad companies get zero money because all their ads are blocked. And I think, you know, they put short-term gains over long-term survival there. And you know, we'll see what happens. You know, again, unsurprisingly, Google has been the company that has dragged its feet the most on this. And so, you know, whereas Apple has really made it easy for consumers to block ads and for app developers to build ad blocking apps, Google has in fact banned ad blocking apps from its app store. Because, you know, those ad blockers really hit Google where it makes most of its money.
Yeah. So are we in a stalemate? Is there any ongoing litigation, or is it a lost cause?
No, I mean, Do Not Track was essentially a political kludge, and it failed. It was an experiment. It failed. We don't have a strong data security regulator in the U.S., and so the Federal Trade Commission could talk about Do Not Track, but they couldn't enforce. They couldn't force companies to promise to respect it. And so the only option that remains is for consumers to use the nuclear option, which is ad blocking. And, you know, I think there are many legitimate reasons to block ads, even if you are not concerned about privacy, given the widespread failure of the ad industry to deal with malware delivered through ads. I think it's a prudent cybersecurity measure for consumers to block ads. In addition to savings on mobile bandwidth. But really where we are today is that if you don't want to be tracked and if you don't want to receive malicious content from ad networks, the only option you have is to block the ads.
Okay. Well, it's time to move on. You gave a TED Talk called Your Smartphone is a Civil Rights Issue. And this kind of fits in with the discussion that Apple was having with the FBI early last year, and then things got suspended for the election. But it sounds like the government, FBI, and other law enforcement agencies want to revisit this, perhaps in the new administration. Do you think Apple can hold its ground? And what we're talking about is the security and privacy of your iPhone through encryption and password protection.
Yes, I mean, I realize that this podcast is aimed at a Mac audience. You know, the focus of my talk, essentially my TED Talk, was that Apple's doing a surprisingly good job with securing data on mobile devices, but Google is not. And Google really dominates the medium and low end of the smartphone market, which means that less affluent consumers, particularly minorities, are going to be more likely to use a device that does not encrypt their data, that does not provide them with regular security updates, which leaves them more vulnerable to government surveillance. And so the reason I said this is a civil rights issue is because what it means is that the people in our society who face the most surveillance and who need protection the most are typically using devices that protect them the least. And that's, in my mind, a digital civil rights issue.
Devices that protect them the least, is that a euphemism for the Android operating system?
Well, so most Android phones today still do not use disk encryption. Android does not use a text messaging app by default that uses end-to-end encryption for text. I think there is a big difference between the default security of Android and the default security of iOS. And then you have the additional factor that most Android phones never receive a security update or rarely receive security updates. And so it's just a lot easier for law enforcement to spy on an Android user's communications, and it's a lot easier for law enforcement to hack into an Android phone. So that's the difference. That's the digital security divide.
We write about that at the Mac Observer, and we warn the readers about the perils of using an Android operating system, especially an older one. And yet, it's wildly popular. That must be frustrating.
Well, look, if Android phones and iPhones were sold for the same price, then I would say, you know, let the market decide. I don't really care. But what bothers me as a civil liberties activist is, again, because Android phones dominate the low end, you know, the kind of consumer who can only afford to spend $99 on an unlocked phone, you know, for that consumer, the choice of smartphone is really between one Android phone and another. The iPhone is never really an option. And so all of the phones that they can buy have bad security. Where, you know, I'm a lot less concerned about a consumer who chooses to buy the new Pixel phone from Google over an iPhone, even though they could afford both.
Okay.
You know, I don't think that encryption or privacy should be a luxury. I think it should be a basic feature in every handset. By all means, you know, compete on, you know, the quality of the lens or the quality of the processor. But I think there should be a baseline of security in every device. And unfortunately, the market is broken here and has failed to deliver phones that are secure by default to the billion plus people using Android devices.
That's too bad. It's too bad. Well, that's one reason to be using an iPhone. That's what we all use here at the Mac Observer, and we promote it quite a bit. So hopefully the people are listening and making smart choices about the security of their devices, because as you said, it is a civil rights issue, and there are organizations fighting for us right and left to keep that privacy. So do you think that in the long run, citizens will be able to claim that they need absolute privacy, or do you think the government will eventually get its way with backdoors?
I mean, I think that the fight that took place last year is probably a one-off. I don't see the FBI publicly strong-arming a company like Apple via the front page of newspapers or in a public court argument. I think the ship has somewhat sailed on that, and in large part due to the fact that newer iPhones are vastly more secure than the device that was in question last year. And so it's not even clear if Apple could provide a method of access to newer handsets in the way that the government wanted assistance last year. I think the real fight
is kind of
a
delicate technical issue now. Let's clarify that. So the older phones were susceptible to certain techniques, exotic techniques, connecting electronics to the phone and so on.
No, so what it was is that there were several security features that exist in the iPhone and on older phones. So the feature, the most important feature here was the feature that wipes the phone after, I think, 10 or 15 unsuccessful entry attempts. And on older iPhones, that feature was enabled in software, and on newer iPhones, that lock feature takes place in hardware. And so the Apple had received this request from the FBI to make a special version of the operating system that had that feature disabled, so the government could try, you know, unlimited attempts to crack the password. Mm-hmm. On newer iPhones, that wipe feature is enforced through the secure enclave. And so there's no way for Apple to build a new operating system that bypasses that feature.
I understand.
Okay. So I don't see, you know, Apple v. FBI part two coming in the next year or two. I think really the government is recognizing, and I think being more public now about the fact that for them, the future of surveillance and the way that they will get around encryption is to attack the handset, either before the data is encrypted or after it's been decrypted. And so they're going to be really going all in on malware and hacking. And so what I expect, you know, to the extent that there are legal disputes between companies like Apple or Google and the government in the future, it will probably be about the extent to which the government can force Apple to push malware to a target's device.
Wow.
Right. And so because of the App Store, because of automatic security updates, every Apple consumer has basically given Apple the ability to push code to their device whenever the company wants. And, you know, how do you know if the app update that you receive is the same app update that your friend receives? It could be a special version of the app that is made for your device and that includes, you know, code given to Apple by the FBI. And, we saw a preview of this almost in the Apple FBI fight last year, where the government, you know, in one of their briefs said to Apple, look, we're being nice. We're asking you to write this code, but we could easily just ask you for the source code to iOS and for the code signing keys and then do this ourselves. And I think that was a preview of the fact that the thing that matters the most is Apple is the code signing keys that protect the update path, that protect which code runs on a device, and the government has signaled quite clearly that they believe they have the right to demand code signing keys from companies, and I think that should terrify every engineer in Silicon Valley.
Is that something you're going to be fighting against?
I mean, I'm going to be working for Congress for the next year, so I'll be working on a whole host of privacy and surveillance issues, but we'll see which ones bubble up to the surface. But this is probably where the surveillance fight is going to move, and the unfortunate thing is any kind of demand to force a company to deliver a malicious update will almost certainly take place behind closed doors. You're not going to see this unfold on the front page of the New York Times, and so, you know, while I hope that civil society groups like the ACLU and EFF get to weigh in, my fear is it will be, you know, Apple's lawyers versus DOJ behind closed doors, and the rest of us won't hear about it for years.
It's too bad. Well, these are all very scary things to talk about. It's something to continue the discussion on at the Mac Observer, and I wish you luck with Congress, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being on the show. This has been an excellent discussion. I appreciate you coming on and telling us about all these things, and it's really been an eye-opener. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Listeners, I really hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.